right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting on the land of Israel.com, straight from the land of Israel to your ears and heart, connected to you wherever you are. Shalom and welcome. Right now, I am at a different Beit Midrash than usual. This one's called Pardes. Pardes on Pierre Koenig Street here in Jerusalem. I'm here with Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, welcome to the show.
It's so good to see you in a new location.
That's right. And, well, it's not new. This is your alternative location. You teach here as well.
I am on the faculty as well.
And
but for you and I, it's relatively new.
That's right. That's right. We have done a show here before, but one of the great things about doing radio in Jerusalem and in Israel is that it's on the go and we have different places. And the most important thing is that there's a fan here today, and I don't mean you listening. I mean there's a fan in the background, and it's cooling me off and making me feel good. Happens to be that we're approaching my 40th birthday. We're between my 40th solar birthday and my 40th Hebrew birthday.
It's Chol HaMoed.
Chol HaMoed, that's right. I actually call it the body birthday and the soul birthday. That's the way I distinguish it. Because if you think about it, the solar birthday is not meaningless, right?
Oh, it is the day in the solar calendar in which we were born, for sure.
But the solar calendar is not just some kind of, you know, funky creation. It's actually the sun going around the earth.
For sure. But listen, the beauty of Am Yisrael's relationship to the calendar is we don't fall out on either pole, right? Meaning the Christian calendar is purely solar, and the Muslim calendar is purely lunar. Our whole task in the world is to integrate between the two.
So that's an interesting topic of between East and West, between East and West. In some ways, we're like, in some ways, we have certain qualities like the Christians, mm-hmm. in terms of, let's say, empathy and a certain sense of individual rights and a liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very Jewish trait. Jews will tell you that Western liberalism is actually a Jewish a trait. On the other hand, and this is maybe forgotten right now, we have certain sides to us that are kind of Muslim, or closer to Islam. The way we pray, the way we speak, the way we
certain tribalism.
Tribalism, maybe the way we clothe ourselves, we're kind of more similar to the Middle East and to
a desire to be grounded in place and soil.
Right, right. So we I know good friends who reject our connection to Westernism. Mm-hmm. And they say, we are not Western people. We are Middle Eastern people, and therefore we're closer to the Arabs. I know that whole. And of course, then there's the whole neocon world, that whole we're conservative, Republican, right-wing folks who are like, we're like the Americans. Those guys are the barbarians, the natives. We got to kind of conquer them with civilization, and we're advanced, and that whole thing. And you sometimes realize that the problem in these ways of identifying, other than the fact that they're not exactly correct, is also they put you in camps that necessarily alienate you from the other camps. And it's all more like a branding and marketing type thing. And I've noticed the power of the brand and the lingo. And it's not even that the idea is so truthfully grounded necessarily. For example, I tell people, I am not a conservative. I say, I'm a hippie. With conservative values. I'm a hippie who took upon himself conservative values, but I'm not a conservative person. And you, on the other hand, we've discussed you're a more conservative person with more liberal values.
I think so, perhaps. You know, this is the core story of this week's Parsha, which is that really what I hear you saying is that there's only one camp, and that's God's camp. And that what it means to be Am Yisrael is that we can identify with, connect to, make bridges between all of the sort of places people perceive themselves to be. But that's only because we see ourselves only in one place, which is in God's camp. And, you know, in my studies of history and my teaching it, it's become very clear to me that there's a geographic gravitas to that reality. I think we've spoken about this before. If you, so to speak, were God, and you were going to create this people who shall dwell alone, right? Am levadad yishkon. It won't be too long till we get to that in our discussion in the Parsha. Where would you put them?
Iceland.
Yeah, the Gobi Desert.
That's right.
Antarctica. You wouldn't
what do you
put
call,
them...
What do you call that, the one with the iguanas, or the one that Darwin went to?
The Galapagos
to?
Islands.
Yeah, Galapagos
exactly.
Over there, down there.
Right? You wouldn't put them at the crossroads of the ancient world. Where
And not so... And still the crossroads
Oh, that's
today.
My point. Yeah. So it was Egypt and Assyria in its day. It became, you know, Greece against Persia, and then in north-south between the Seleucids and the Ptolemaic, and then between Rome and Parthia, and now... Between East and West. I mean, look at the battle between Islam and the West. To say that it doesn't sort of center on here, I think, is to miss the point.
Right.
And it begs the question.
And let us remember that world wars were fought many times between Islam and Christendom, between East and West.
Absolutely.
The Crusades is very much about
which
that.
Which was over the physical possession of this chunk of land where we sit
right
now.
That's right.
Yeah, and so this to me is the physical manifestation of a spiritual reality. As you were saying, between your solar birthday and your lunar birthday, right? There's always an embodiment of the spiritual principle. And the spiritual principle we represent is that there's only one camp.
That's interesting that you say that. It's interesting. I agree, of course, with what you're saying because it's truth. But I would also say that in some ways the Jewish people also represent not one camp of capital T truth, but in some ways we do embody all camps. I mean, it's say there's some representation of the 70 original souls of the Jewish people to the 70 nations, and in some ways we are the best Germans. We are the best Americans. We are the best of those places. And in some way culturally, and I speak now as a mixed cultural person who actually holds in his brain East and West, and different sides of understanding things, which is, by the way, sometimes awesome, sometimes painful.
Yes.
That in some ways, it's not that we have, it's true what you're saying, we have one kind of an ultimate camp, and yet at the same time, I feel myself to be partially Russian, partially Middle Eastern, partially Western.
That's because you're a Jew. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what I'm driving at, is that this illusion that we've mentioned before, that what it means to there be for there to be one camp is that everyone has to be the same, is a failed vision of universalism. We're seeing it happen today in the breakup of what the world thought to be like the whole progressive notion of the gradual unification of our globe in Brexit, right? So you could look at that as just a retrograde moment. Look, so they're going backwards, like the whole world was moving forward and these people just threw on the brakes. Or you could say, no, what this is a recognition of the reality that to bring the whole world together, you can't do it by making everyone the same. What you have to do is create a context in which people can actually be who they are, and yet there is something which unites them, right? That you don't demand homogeneity as the entrance fee for unity. That there's a potential complexity that can be brought together, right? And this is embodied in our story by the tribes. Think about it. One God, one land, one Torah, 12 tribes. And since the brothers beat up Joseph and sent him down to Egypt, it seems on the surface of that's only caused problems. And yet they represent the exact reality you're speaking of, which is it must be that unity does not demand the sacrifice of my individuality.
Let's take a step back for a second, clarify things for people. We're on Spiritual Cafe. That's my segment with Rabbi Mike Foyer on the Yishai Fleischer Show, landofisrael.com. The Torah portion is Korach, a powerful and painful Torah portion in which the rebellion now is not going to be against God, as in the golden calf. It's not against the land of Israel. It's going to be direct, as in Parshat Shlach that we learned, it's actually going to be directed against the leadership, against the Kohanim, the priestly group within the Levites, other Levites. This is a tribe, the Levitical tribe, the Levites, are the ones that are generally the ones that don't get in trouble. They stay out of trouble. In so many situations, they're not counted amongst the other peoples, or they weren't sent into the land of Israel as one of the spies.
Correct.
Okay? So it's a group
that didn't participate in the sin of the calf.
Right. They're always out of it. And sometimes you expect that this group, from which this incredible family of Aaron, Miriam, and of course, there's a great teacher, Moses, come out of, you expect this family to go through smooth, and suddenly comes this Torah portion where there's infighting, one that really challenges the great peoples of that generation, and also stirs up unbelievable, deadly wrath of God. And we talked a few minutes ago about Islam versus the West. We talked about the crossroads. There's another crossroads that we didn't mention even further to the East, and that's Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Russia is a big part of this country. Ironically, this country, Israel, is some kind of amalgam between Jews coming out of Islamic countries, Sephardi countries, and Jews coming out of Russia.
Yes, absolutely.
And communism. And that is a weird mixture. Where
all you have to do is go to any bureaucratic office to see it in its finest.
That's right. And most Westerners, Western Jews that are coming here are coming with you know, Westernism and liberalism, and this country is utterly weird to them because this admixture of Russia and Sephardiness and Middle Eastness is indeed a wacky mixture. Now, the reason I mention that is because when Russian Jews, like my parents, read this week's Torah portion, they immediately sense, and I've seen them almost viscerally react to reading the words of Korach, who says, hey, we're all equal. We're all the same. Why do you, Moses, why do you think you're the czar? Why do you think that you are the president? You are trying to wrest away power from the rest of us, and we're all equal. We need rights for the people. Rights for the proletariat. We are together, the working class. And you should see the reactions that people like my parents do. When we go into the rabbinic literature on the claims of Korach, it gets even more solidified, this thought. When he comes in, he says, hey, a house full of books, a house full of Torah Sfarim, does it need a mezuzah? And Moses says, yes. He says, what's wrong with you? Don't you understand? It's full of Torah already. Does it need a mezuzah? It's exactly a communist type of outlook. It's like, you don't need leadership. You don't need, you know, the tzaddik. You don't need, we're all together. We're all equal. We're all these, you know, these fine books all together. That's what we are in a library. And people sense that.
And he would have been fine if it weren't for where he started.
By the way, wasn't he very wealthy himself?
He was fabulously wealthy, according to the sages, and an extremely wise, or at least open-eyed. It was called a pikeach, right? So a person who really could see. He could see what was going on. And so the question that...
Politically astute,
very learned. And so the question that underlies the whole parsha is, like, what was he thinking? I mean, okay, 10 plagues, splitting the Red Sea, standing at Sinai. Even if you really believe what you're saying, you're going to go up against Moses?
But if Moses is politically weak, if it becomes known in the camp that he's not going to lead you into the land of Israel,
right,
this is the moment to attack.
So there is the progression that we've seen between last week's parsha and this week, and it's definitely true. But I think that the deepest insight into Korach comes from the first word of the parsha. If you look, it says, "Vayikach Korach ben Yitzhar ben Kehat ben Levi." Right? Korach, and it gives his lineage, he took. And you know what it doesn't do? It never tells you what he took. It just says he took. And the sages struggle around understanding, like, he took what? In the end, what they come
and
to...
And by the way, this is not just to clarify for our listeners, this is not a Torah mistake. It's not that somehow some silly editor forgot to put in a word.
Oh, yeah. No, semantics? No.
Right. The Torah is saying to you, and he took, and it says to you, hey, ask this question. What did he take?
Anytime you find inconsistency, and especially what appears to be contradiction in the text, it is a flag that says, dig here. Because what you're encountering is the limitations of language to communicate depth of meaning. And therefore, it relies on the reader to do the work to derive the meaning which couldn't be communicated in a text that would be available to everyone. So here he takes himself, is that what they come to? He takes himself to the side. He steps to the side and he looks at the situation and decides what is best. And in that act of removing himself from the whole, of perceiving himself as something other than, is what underlies, by the way, the whole discourse of rights. See, if I'm me and you're you and there's an absolute boundary that divides us, so then I'm able to think about, well, what are my rights in this situation? And then we're going to have to come to some social contract that is able to negotiate our rights. But if my basic premise, which is where Am Yisrael was coming from before this, is there's only one thing here. There's only one thing happening. Like I said, there's the camp of God. There's the divine vision. There's the Torah coming down the road. That doesn't mean that my experience of it is the same as yours. Don't mistake me. But we're both experiencing the same thing, and that's what people have a hard time grasping. When we all stood at Sinai, do you really think we all saw the same thing? It clearly not. But nevertheless, we want to think it was one thing, right? And then it becomes an argument about doctrine. Like, do you believe this? Do you believe that? No, slow down. There's only one thing happening here. But Korach, in taking himself to the side, says, no, I'm my own individual. I'm discreet. Therefore, we can begin to speak about rights, right? Because what belongs to me and what belongs to you, right? And in that motion of taking, first and foremost, taking control of his destiny, he's no longer, you know, part of the whole, you see how it spirals toward what in the end is a very self-serving manipulation of a profound truth. When he says, Hayida kulam kedoshim, right, that the whole community is holy, nobody argues with that.
But he's not giving.
He's not
giving rights.
And well,
he's taking.
Even if you're giving rights, this is the fundamental mistake. And this is why there is no word for rights in the Torah. The whole discourse of rights is founded on the idea that the individual is the primary unit of human existence. It's a, historically, by the way, it's a post-Enlightenment chiddush. It's an innovation, right? The whole idea of the social contract. Before that, not just in Am Yisrael, although primarily so, but even traditional societies see the collective as an intrinsic. Therefore, even to speak of rights is a secondary discourse. The primary discourse is obligations, right? That's why, you know, John F. Kennedy, in one of his more famous phrases, says, "Ask not what the country can do for you, but what you can do for the country." You know, that was an innovation for Americans. But the reality is that sense of obligation is the core of the Torah's perspective on the relationship between God and man and man and man.
Right. But at that moment when JFK said that, in some ways, he was echoing something that was happening in the East, in Russia, that was doing it to an extreme, which is, you know, the American idea is that the country should do for you, but the Soviet idea is that we should all do for the country. And that can be taken to an extreme as well.
Which is why, in the end, once again, you find Am Yisrael right in between.
Right.
Right? Because the reality is, one thing happened at Sinai, and it created an obligation out of all of us. And yet, what you're going to do is not going to be the same what I do. And therefore, your life experience and what comes to you in the world will not be the same. And therefore, the Levi'im, right, who were chosen by God to play a particular role in the unfolding of the divine plan, aren't. Their obligations are not the same, and therefore the role they play is not the same. So Korach's argument, hey, everybody's holy, I should be just as good as the high priest, is true except for one thing. It's not what God said. And in this, he just goes straight back to the sin of Adam HaRishon.
Right, right. He goes to the sin of... and
which was the original taking.
Right, the original taking. Very good.
Right, the taking of the fruit was... like. Let's go there for a second. What was Adam thinking? I mean, he was obviously... intimate with the divine, and he heard from God himself, listen, it's going to be great. You live in the garden. There's just one thing. Don't touch that tree. Or actually, he didn't say don't touch it. Don't eat that fruit. What could Adam have been thinking?
Well, we spoke about it last week. I think I mentioned to you that my friend Alex Trayman said to me that he had read a midrash, which when the minute he said it to me, it was like a lightning bolt, that the snake told... Chava, he told Eve, he said to her, God ate from the fruit. That's how he became powerful. He just wants to keep you out of power.
Right, so that's the snake's voice.
Right, which is exactly what Korach is saying. You took power, Moses, and the reason you don't share it is because you want to be lording over us.
So that for sure is half the story. But notice the snake talks to Eve. It doesn't talk to Adam.
Right.
Right. When Adam moves toward that fruit, the Nefesh HaChaim, of Chaim Mevolosian, has a beautiful insight. He says, the truth is, we have to say that Adam's instinct was good. What was his instinct? He wanted to serve God. And he said, listen, I'm trapped in this very simplistic black and white world. God said no. And all I can do is just not do what he told me not to do. But if I eat from the fruit, suddenly I'll be in a world of nuance, of right and wrong, good and evil instead of truth and not truth. And the potential to serve God will be so much richer. And so he does it. And the reality is, he was correct except for one thing. He placed himself in the place of God. It's kind of like he walked into this hall of mirrors and he said, this is going to be amazing. I just got to keep track of that door. Oops. It closes behind him. And the principle by which he could judge between good and evil, which would have allowed him to serve richly in the world, disappeared with his assertion that he was right and God was wrong, with that taking of the reshut of the domain into himself. That's why it has to wait till Sinai to be fixed. When God finally says, listen, I'm going to open up heaven and earth. I will give you back that standard by which to guide. You're still in a world of good and evil. And therefore, I can't be you and you can't be me. And the world is always going to have an element of subjectivity, which is important to its divine service. And yet God has graced us with a standard by which we can determine in this crazy world what's up and what's down.
All right. So the standard is being taken away. The standard in this case is also not just the Torah, but also the righteous person, the tzaddik, Moses.
And there's no separation between them at this point in the narrative.
And there's a challenge against that.
And that's why it's such a profound challenge, because he's not just going after the politics. He's trying to uproot the whole story. Right? It's kind of like, imagine right now if one of the people listening to the show who's having their own experience of what's happening right now suddenly said, wait a minute, and stepped in here, took the mic away from me, and started to speak. Because it's their world, right? That's what Korach does.
Right. All right. So let's take a pause for a second. A few important things I want to say. First thing, this show is sponsored by Jack, in honor of his wife Lillian, and his sister Sarah, who's Sarah, who is also a donor to the show and is part of the whole project of Spiritual Cafe and of all the various projects that we're involved in, and thelandofisrael.com. They are going to be in Israel this week. That's right. And I want to wish them a humongous mazel tov for their son.
Mazel tov, mazel tov.
And I can't wait to see them, their whole family, and the 80 people that are coming with them on two buses to the land of Israel. I'm very excited for Jack. I'm very excited for Lily and mazel tov. Can't wait to see the whole ganze mishpuche. Okay? And that's not the way you say it in Brooklynese, in that Brooklynese in any case. But I am very excited to see the whole family reunited here in the land of Israel from actually other parts of the globe as well. Very exciting. Also from South America. I'm very excited to see them. So that's issue number one. Issue number two is that I had a chance this past Shabbat to be with young Zionists, young men who have come to the land of Israel in various forms, working at places, learning Torah, and living in different places, but all with this ideology to be connected to the land and connected to the story of Israel. So I want to do a shout out to my boys who I got to hang out with this past Shabbat, which is Dov and Chaim and Ben Zion and Nisim. Okay, so I had a four-guy Shabbaton at my house for my birthday, and I was like, the way I'm going to celebrate my birthday is going to like be with young guys that are going to take it to the next generation. Also, we were at the Western Wall. We bumped into a listener, Tammy from Singapore. Tammy and her husband, Yishai, from Singapore. Tammy said to me that she had written me emails in the past. I looked for her email, could not find it. So, Tammy, you are more than welcome to write in anytime, Yishai at thelandofisrael.com. And furthermore, mazal tov to Tammy and Yishai on the bar mitzvah of their son. And mazal that's tov. Why they're in. And I'd love to get out to Singapore just to, A, check it out and speak to the Jewish community there or anybody else who's interested in the story of Israel. So, Tammy, thank you so much for stopping me at the Kotel. I really, really appreciate it. It was awesome to see you and your family. Hebron is the Jewish community where I get a chance to work and to try to sell the story of, check out my new phrase here, the founding fathers and mothers. I'm going to borrow an American phrase, founding fathers and mothers. I don't know if patriarchs and matriarchs is very 2016.
Patriarchal has a pretty bad ring to it in the 21st century.
Yeah, and also, you know, it doesn't. But how about founding fathers and mothers who are buried in Hebron, and the whole biblical story starts there. That's the root of Israel, the root of the Jewish people. And it's also what I think should be an international heritage site. I want to thank the good people of Hebron. I want to I want to recommend to you to come on a tour. Just check out hebronfund.org, hebronfund.org. And we have tours every week, every week. If you have kids who are here in Israel, send them on the tour with Rabbi Simcha Hachbaun, and just an incredible opportunity to see Hebron and the truth of Hebron. So, check out the website or write an email to tour@hebronfund.org. So that was some of the stuff that I wanted to take care of. I also want to say that since I'm turning 40, something else is turning 40. My mom, God bless her, is a lot like you in the sense, Rabbi Mike, in that she is an incredible student of history and has an incredible memory of Israel, of history, and especially Israeli history and Jewish history. And once I tricked her, I said to her, Mom, do you remember Entebbe? Do you remember what happened? Do you remember those days? And she was like searching her mind, and it was though there was like a blackout there. And she was like, why can't I remember that? I'm like, you know why, Mom? Because I was born on the day the plane was taken, and my brit was on the day of the rescue operation.
Really?
That's right.
Wow.
So my mom has a little hole in her memory due to that episode and of me being born. And so
thank God.
When it's my 40th birthday, that means it's also Entebbe's 40th birthday.
Wow.
And Entebbe was a moment of another one of those 6-day war moments. Another one of those moments where the strength of Israel, the might of Israel, and the God of Israel, who was with the Jewish people, in the message that it sent to the world, that we will rescue our people, that we will go to far distances, that the Holocaust is no longer, you know, going to return. There was a great message that was sent into the world and a great inspiration. Happened to be, and interestingly, and maybe you have a thought about this, it was July 4th, 1976, the American Bicentennial. It was exactly that day. Do you think there's a connection between those two things?
I'm not sure about the dates. It's a little beyond my thinking. But as you were describing all the elements there, what really came up for me was it was an expression of the integrity of Am Yisrael. Right? In this sense of with all the arguments that happen in this country about where we should be going and where we came from and what we should be doing, there is a core sense of we're in this together, right? And that's so much of, in my understanding, what drove the Entebbe raid. So we're simply not going to let that happen to our people. And it's something I pray night and day should remain as a base level foundation of the fabric of our society.
Yes, I pray for that as well, although I sometimes am a little bit, how should I say, I would like to see it be more overt, because I think that allowing the incredible hate that is being taught and generated in the jihadist circles all around us and in the armament that is being procured and aimed at us, especially from places like South Lebanon, where 200,000 rockets, serious rockets, are being trained at us, and we know that, and that we're not kind of, destroying those things and not letting that happen. I sometimes wonder if we have that same moral commitment to making sure that there'd be zero tolerance for Jewish death or Jewish pain.
Yeah, I think the problem is that the other elements that drove Entebbe there are lacking. I mean, if God forbid they began to launch those rockets, there's no question in my mind that the whole country would rise up in protection. The problem is we lack the vision of the God of Israel, and we lack the vision of the historical mission of the Jewish people that would allow us to be proactive in realizing that integrity of commitment to each other.
Well, right after this segment of the show, Spiritual Cafe, we're going to have an Entebbe hero, one of the fighters of Sayeret Matkal, who was there. There's even a famous picture of him, Shai Ish Shalom. This is an interview I recorded a few years ago, but I'm going to replay it in honor of the 40th, and I'm very excited about that. And you're going to just be awed by this awesome interview. So stay tuned for Shai Ish Shalom. And afterwards, there's going to be an interview with three young ladies who have decided to dedicate their life to helping Jews come home and make it in the land of Israel. You've got to stick around for the Yishai Fleisher Show for the next parts. I'm telling you, Shai Ish Shalom and these three amazing young ladies who are just the next Sayeret Matkal, in that they are helping the next generation of the Jewish people come home. That is just great radio for you, and will leave you inspired. And that's exactly what, you know, at 40 years of Entebbe, we should be. We should be inspired. Speaking of inspiration, let me tell you a little tiny story. Back to Parshat Korach. It was some years ago, before I was married, right after college, so that must have been the year 2000, that I took a trip to visit my good friend Ari Silverman, who was working at the time in Holland and in Amsterdam. And I got to spend time in that beautiful city, Amsterdam, seeing its museums, following Vincent van Gogh around a little bit, following Anne Frank around a little bit, and trying to understand the spirit of this very European capital, which has so many interesting, so much history and so much Jewish history and so much just kind of flow. And I know exactly what Torah portion it was. I know exactly what Torah portion it was back then. It was Parshat Korach. And the reason that I remember that it was Parshat Korach is because I was reading the Torah portion, and that next day after I read the Torah portion, I went to the market where they sell flowers. What are the flowers there? The tulips, right? And I was like, wow, this is some color. And I'm colorblind, by the way. And it was like, wow, this is some incredible color. And that city has a lot of rain in it, a lot of cloudiness, but like sun bursts through. And there's a lot of these like rich grays that interplay with like reds and yellows and blues, whatever it is. And I remember that this week's Torah portion, one of the ways that the Jewish people gain peace is that when they all complain about who is the chosen leader of the Jewish people, God's answer is, okay, collect all the staffs, bring them into the tent of meeting, and pick up the staffs in the morning. And they came back, and guess what? Aaron's staff flowered an almond flower, and it yielded almonds. And this was some kind of testimony, some kind of answer. And I always thought to myself, that's kind of funny, what a flower. I mean, we're talking about people are dying left and right here. Fire's coming out of the sky. And at the end, it's like, isn't this a beautiful flower? Well, there you go, folks. See?
But that's exactly it, because what's happening here, and it's been for, unfortunately, a few weeks in the parsha, is tremendous negativity, right? Death, rejection, exile, wandering. And it's very clear to the people at this point that it's coming from God, right? Like, who else is pulling off, you know, the flame that comes out and consumes 250 people offering incense? And yet, so you have to ask yourself, why are they still rejecting? Why are they still pushing? Why is there a need for something more? And I think the answer is that just because a person intellectually accepts a reality, it doesn't mean that they can live with it, right? And what they need is that sign of life. And that's the powerful symbolism of the flowering staff. I mean, if you think about it, each tribal leader had his staff. Why a staff? Well, it's an important symbol and it looks important. So let's go deeper to the roots. What does a staff do? It gives you power to hit other people without having to get your hands dirty. On some level, that's what a staff represents. It's the extension of my reach to bop you in the head, right? And if that's all that leadership is, death, plague, exile, then even if people accept intellectually, they'll reject it. Whereas our own staff flowers, it brings life. And that's what God's trying to tell them. Listen, I know your experience of this so far has been very hard, but I want you to know something, that we're after life here. And that's why there are commandments to plant trees and grow when we get into the land, because that's the vision of leadership. It needs to be one of fruitfulness and beauty and life-giving.
It's a beautiful image, the flowering staff.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful image, and it's also subtly an image of resurrection of the dead.
Absolutely. And in the same way that these people who were condemned, as we spoke about last week, they were condemned to death. And even though God said only the generation that died or that came out from Egypt is going to die in the wilderness, that's all well and good for those of us who read this story through every year. Right there in the middle of it, and they don't know what's going to be. They've just blown it on the level that their goal got pushed off by 40 years. You think they feel good about themselves? You think they feel capable of rising to the challenge of 40 years of wandering? For sure not. And this is God's message to them. Listen, I have high expectations of you. You are going to flower. And therefore, it gives the people the hope that they can actually rise to that expectation.
They're revived. I love that image of the flowering staff. And I think every single one of us can also think of a staff as something a little bit lifeless. You could bob somebody on the head, but it's something that is unrooted, you know, and lost its connection to the earth and is really a dead piece of wood in your mm-hmm. hand or in your life. And there are parts of our personality that are dead wood.
Yes.
You know, and our kind of...
Yet we all often lean on them anyway.
Right.
Right.
I know a guy with a wooden leg named Smith. What's the name of his other leg? Remember that one? No.
Oh, boo.
You don't remember that? That's from Mary Poppins, another great inspiration. In any case, the point is that maybe the sign is also for us that whatever we lean on it, but maybe it's kind of dead inside. It could still flower. It could still, you know, be reborn. And I don't tell me you're too old. Don't tell me that you weren't raised that way. We learn another 40-year-old was Rabbi Akiva, who was one way, and then with a realization that yes, his staff can flower. His heart is not harder than stone, and you know, a new life opened up for him, and he indeed ended up in Pardes, which is exactly where we are right now, in the Pardes Yeshiva. By the way, what's the website for Pardes?
It's pardes.org.il.
Pardes.org.il. Check it out. There's a lot more liberal-minded folks here, and if you're looking for a Torah from that perspective, you will certainly find here a very deep Torah, very beautiful Torah.
And find my faculty page there. I've got a bunch of recorded shirim as well.
Okay, so faculty page of Rabbi Mike Foyer, who's usually at Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, sulamyaakov.com, and you also have this New History project.
That's right. I've got a crowdfunding campaign going on right now. If you go to Patreon, patreon.com, and you look for M. Foyer, that's me, you can find the campaign. It's great. I'm telling the story of Jewish history in a series of 30 podcasts, and for even $1 a podcast, you can help make it happen.
And if you can't remember that, then you write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com, as somebody did this week, and I forward it to Rabbi Mike, so you can definitely stay connected. I also want to thank the Michel family out in Switzerland, who are lovers of Israel, great friends of this program, and great friends of all of our efforts. I want to thank you so much. I want to thank Danny Kay, a lot of the good folks out there. I want to thank my good friend Andy out in Atlanta. I want to thank my good friend Eric and his whole family out in Milwaukee, the good folks there. And wish them a lot of success. What was the last thing that I wanted to say to you, friends? Oh, here we go. This is it. Guess what? An amazing piece of news. You know that the three flags that I had were all claimed in great victory of flying the flag of Israel by three folks who took part in the show and donating to the show. A new flag has come in. One flag that we recently put up It turned out to be not so strong, so it got rips quickly.
False flag.
Right, and therefore we took it down quick because we cannot, and that's the weird thing about flying a flag. Listen to this. It can be a big sanctification of God's name, and yet if it looks ugly, tattered, it immediately flips to being a desecration of God's name. An irony that I've learned in the business of being in the foreground, which is that when you are a sanctification of God's name, you could immediately... you're immediately a candidate for sacrilege. And so we had to take that flag down very quickly. But you can get that flag. You can have that flag. It flew in Jerusalem on the Mount of Olives. If you're interested in competing and supporting the show, please write me an email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. All right, Rabbi Mike Foyer, thanks so much for hanging out with me at Pardes.
Always a pleasure. Shabbat shalom.
May our deadwood flower.
Amen.
And may Jewish leadership have the love of the people. And, of course, the love of God. By the way, I've been trying very hard is not to curse my leaders.
It's critical.
I believe it's the toughest Jewish mitzvah.
It might be.
It might be. Don't curse your Jewish leaders. Embrace them somehow, even if you're pining away for something even greater. And let us now hear from somebody who may not be a political leader, but is a person who went out there and put everything on the line to rescue the Jewish people. And hear the emotion. It may not come from a very deep Torah place, but it comes from the deepest place of a bond between the Jewish people. What did you call it before?
The integrity.
The integrity of the Jewish people. You want to hear some integrity? Stay tuned, because here comes Shai Ishalom, Rabbi Mike Foyer. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom, Ishai.
Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Stay tuned.
Rabbi Isaac Nissenbaum, one of the founders of the religious Zionist Mizrahi movement, wrote, "The objective of Mizrahi is the total revival of our nation in all its aspects, to revive Judaism in our hearts and to revive our hearts for Judaism. The Land of Israel Network is powered by the Mizrahi World Movement."
One of the most famous events of Jewish heroics in recent Jewish history is Operation Entebbe, which was the counter-terrorist hostage rescue mission carried out by the IDF at Entebbe Airport in Uganda on the 4th of July, 1976. A week earlier, an Air France plane was taken with 248 passengers. It was hijacked by members of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and also German revolutionary cells. And it was flown to Entebbe, and all non-Israeli passengers were released, except for one French citizen. And the IDF acted on intelligence provided by the Mossad, prepared a plan to take over with military strike against the hostage takers and the Ugandan military troops, which took part in the hostage crisis as well. And the operation took place at night, and Israeli transport planes carried about 100 commandos over 2,500 miles, 4,000 kilometers, to Uganda for the rescue operation. It took a week of planning. The whole thing lasted only 90 minutes, where 102 hostages were rescued, 5 Israeli commandos were wounded, and one, the commander, Lieutenant Colonel Yonatan Netanyahu, was killed. He's the brother of Benjamin Netanyahu. All the hijackers were killed, and also 45 Ugandan soldiers were killed. 30 Soviet-built MiG-17s and 21s of the Ugandan Air Force were destroyed. 3 hostages, sadly, were also killed in the operation. And 24 hours later, a 4th Israeli hostage was killed by Ugandan army officers at a nearby hospital. The operation is known as Operation Thunderbolt or Operation Yonatan, to commemorate Yoni Netanyahu. We're going to hear an interview now with one of the people who was a young soldier from Sayeret Matkal, the elite Israeli unit, who actually took part in the operation. And this interview took place itself in a fascinating place, not all the way out in Uganda, but in the foothills of Efrat at a fantastic tactical range where it's a self-defense school, a shooting school, a first responders anti-terror school. And this man that you're going to hear from is an instructor there at this range called Caliber 3. All right, folks, I am here at Caliber 3 on the outskirts of Efrat. This is one of Israel's premier security training institutions. It is for civilian and military and paramilitary, i.e. security teams in Judea and Samaria. This is where they get the best training. Everything from how to use weapons, how to defend oneself, hand-to-hand combat, and really getting what we call in Israel, liot miktsui, to be professional, to really professionalize the abilities, because response times are measured in nanoseconds and not in minutes and not in a long time to aim. They're measured at super quick intervals between the terrorist getting the best of you or you getting the best of a terrorist. We have an expression in Judaism that says, "Hakam lo gachash kem lo go." He who arises to kill you, you get up just a little bit earlier to get them first. And I'm standing here with a man who is one of Israel's very best, and that makes him one of the world's very best, counter-terrorist security trainers, who himself had has a long past in security forces, special operations, has been injured many times in the line of duty for Israel. And his name is, paradoxically and humorously, Shai Ish Shalom. His family name means a man of peace. And I'm sure that to him, there's no contradiction, there's no paradox, because being ready for war lets you be peaceful, or wanting peace comes with being prepared for war. Shai Shalom, a few minutes about yourself. Tell us about how does a person, an Israeli, and that's what you are very much to me, an Israeli, how does an Israeli come about to become one of the world's best security experts? Where does that come in the Israeli soul?
My generation grew up after the Holocaust. My generation grew up while Arab countries and terrorists and armies surrounded us, and we were very insecure. Meaning, when I reached the army, and it was after Yom Kippur War, 73, the notion of a kibbutz, remember, kibbutz, that my father founded Hanit at the age of 38, I remember the one of the Holocaust days, Memorial Days, when I'm feeling very, very, very blue. Every Holocaust day. Why? Because I feel that's something to remember. That's something that I must avoid with all my essence from happening again. And I remember in the elite unit I served, sitting in the tent in a very, very difficult after. Very difficult training, very blue like I always am, but I see my members quite the same. Nobody was talking about it before. And I asked one of my mates, Rami, what's going on? He said, no, everything's okay. No, no, you're blue. No, I'm fine. So I initiated saying, I'm blue because this is the Holocaust Day and I joined Sayyid Matkal only because this will not happen again to the Jewish people as long as I can contribute my best. And he said, I was ashamed to talk about it, but the same, and all the people around said the same. This is the essence. Meaning, any person who admits to be Jewish, doesn't matter religious, this kind or this kind, non-religious, but Israel he cares for. If anybody shoots now from here, you know where will I be? I'll be getting the bullet for you, because this is my essence. Now, we must train best in order to, when you reach the real time, your ability drops within 40 to 60% to your best ability in training. So train hard, because you are going to drop very, very low. Speaking about Caliber 3, this is one of the six schools for security authorized by the Israeli police and Israeli army and the Israeli special forces to train very specialized bodies. We are all coming from the battlefields. Some of us are high rank like me. I'm a colonel. Sharon is a colonel. And I'm already old. I'm not in the army anymore. In my time, it's Tzionut, as I called, to take a guy, Rafi, and make him in 6 days a good security, a proper security guard. And I give him my heart, it will ache him. I'm going to beat him up. I'm going to put him on the ground. I'm going up just for him when and if the time comes, I know I gave him my best. This is still not. All of us feel bad once anything happens involving Israeli forces and we did not participate in. And we know that it can bring us to die. And we're willing to die. Meaning we're not taking the step to get into dangerous action on the whole. No, if it deserves me getting hurt or that, no, this I did not know. We know that's what it takes. So we're ready to take it.
So one of the many battlefields that you experienced was the famous Entebbe battle. There are stories that you can tell us, and there are stories you can't tell us. But you were part of the unit that had the great audacity to fly halfway around the world and to rescue those hostages that had been taken a week before. It happens to be that I was born on the day that it was taken, and my breed was on the day of your operation. And I just want to ask you for a few words. I know you can't talk about everything, and I know that you had only your perspective on the battle, but just a few words about that, because for so many of us, it is... not only is it a ray of hope, but it says that the state of Israel will protect the Jewish people around the world. That's the message of Entebbe. What can you tell me about what you remember?
Look, the terrorists started at the early 70s, after the Munich 72 Olympics. They started to hijack planes. At the beginning, they intended to hijack planes to explode them over Tel Aviv, over Jerusalem, to make. Then they started, they can't make it. They started to hijack planes in order to ask things, okay, to demands. After Sabena, what they did here, and they landed here, they hijacked this plane of Air France and hijacked it to Entebbe. Now, you probably know that Uganda was a best friend of Israel about 5 years before. They trained with us, we trained them there, we made their agriculture, we made their hospital, they graduated our universities and so on. And then Idi Amin, something evolved and he decided that we are his enemies. Okay. I remember on the day of the hijack, I told some of my mates, this is the time for us to make plans. This is the time. And I was just a junior, nothing. And apparently they did. Now, it wasn't an operation of one unit. There were four units, each one on other device. There was only one stage very dangerous in that operation, namely two. This was the time when the planes with the warriors were not covered by Israeli planes. 20 minutes from Nairobi to Entebbe. Of course, Erat Matkal was in charge of the main thing of taking the hostages, freeing the hostages. There was Mofaz with his force, with a new terminal. There was Wisagi and Matan on the Air Force base and so on. So some of us came by the plane, some of us came by the Mossad, doesn't matter, and we carried it out. And no vanity, no sense of I'm better than anybody else and so on. We just did what we did because, as I said before, I'm willing to give my life for you, even though I don't know you. Because this is my nature. That's what I'm getting paid for. Okay, that's my... So it was very narrow. Everyone had only a narrow perspective. I know that my time, freeing hostages, nothing really exciting. nothing I can say, okay, now I'll see. We came in, we did our job, we were accurate. 99% of the success of this operation lies within luck. Well, within luck, not because we're good. It was could easily be catastrophical. But as a Jew, we are willing to take the risk because we won't let any Holocaust happen again. This is all I can say.
That was 1976. Today is 2012. There's a lot of people that come here from all over the world. A lot of Jews that come here from the diaspora. And within a few minutes, a few hours, they get to feeling that they're more Israeli, that they're more able to defend themselves, which is part of the ethos of Zionism. And it gives them a sense that they're part of the story more, that they can defend themselves like they haven't been able to maybe 2,000 years. That's the last thing I want to ask you about. What does that feel like to you? From Entebbe to today, 2012, here working at Caliber 3, giving people that confidence, that firepower to be a Jew in the land of Israel.
I think that you're confusing something. When Israel was counting few Jews, few, very few Jews, everyone knew someone who knew you. Meaning there was no way that you could say, okay, I won't do it and nobody knows. Everybody knew. So we had to be very... Now the... It's our fault. We took our children and said, okay, I had such a bad time. Not bad time, such a tough time. Let's lachsoch et ze mimenu. How will I say it?
Let's keep it away from them.
Yeah. So that's what we do. We suddenly we accuse him and him and him and him, and we don't let our children cope. Now, when they have to cope, they don't know how to do it because we always covered for them. So when I'm here, and I'm taking the youngsters and showing them it's their responsibility and be tough. Nobody will come for your rescue, only yourself. No father, no mother, not you. And when a tourist comes and I'm telling him from the States, from France, from wherever, telling him, are you feeling risky, under risk? Either you leave the place and come here because here it's safe, either you start organizing your people in order to feel safe there. But don't cry. Don't cry. It's your choice, nobody else's. So my part and our part is to let a Jew or every human being be a human being and take responsibility for his existence. Me, I'm not aggressive. I love people, I love music, I love children, I love everything. Why? Because I don't need it. In my toolbox, there lies the aggressiveness. As soon as I need it, in no time I have it. I don't need it. Once I don't have it, I'm afraid to use it. I'm going to either not use it when necessary, either use it when not necessary. So I'm trying to teach people to get set, to get into aggressiveness when needed in order to save lives. Not more than that. So the tourist from the diaspora come in. First of all, you must know it's safe here for Jews. You must know the safest place on earth for Jews. But if you want to be a Jew and be in the diaspora and you don't feel safe, make it safe for yourself. And it's easy to do. Easy to do. Either or come here.
Shai Shalom from Sayeret Matkal to Caliber 3, 57 years old. You already have children also in special units here in the Army.
And one grandchild.
Mazal tov, and thank you so much for all you do.
Toda lachem, and may we see you only in good times.
All right, folks, I hope you enjoyed Shai Ish Shalom. I got to tell you, just to be next to that man is inspirational. And in general, the Yishai Fleischer Show provides you with some inspirational voices, and it provides me with the opportunity to be next to some of those inspirational voices, including Rabbi Mike Foyer and Shai Ish Shalom. I want to thank the good people who make this show possible. I want to thank Ben Bresky for helping engineer this show, and my good buddy Moshe Herman out of Idaho, who makes this show get out to you, to the world. I want to thank you very much. I want to thank thelandofisrael.com, the great folks and the great shows that are part of this new and innovative network that is bringing out the voice of Israel to the world. And I also want to thank the good people at Hebron, Hebron.com, H-E-B-R-O-N. The founding fathers and mothers are waiting for you to visit. Check out HebronFund.org and our tours there. You are going to be inspired when you show up. And you can check out our Facebook page, which is Hebron Official, and you could see all the incredible people that get to touch history by showing up in Hebron and showing that they're unafraid. Folks, next week I'm going to be in San Francisco. So if you're in San Francisco and you're a listener, you're a friend, please write me an email quick, Yishai@thelandofisrael.com. I'm going to be in San Francisco and a little bit in the San Francisco and maybe even in the Sacramento area. I got some important meetings there. So if you want to see me and this is your opportunity if you're not coming to the Land of Israel anytime soon. So write me an email to Yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Folks, there's a lot of people out there that want to hurt us. They want to hurt our narrative. They want to hurt our story. They want to cut off our roots. They want to cut off our dreams. We won't let them. There's going to be Sayeret Makal and Shai Shalom are going to come in on the C-130 Hercules and rescue us. There's going to be Rabbi Mike Foyer is going to pull us out of the depths of darkness with Spiritual Cafe. And of course, there's the God above who is giving us inspiration and a sense of heroism because we're coming back home. We're rebuilding our land and our country. We're going to be a light unto the nations, and nobody's going to stop us, and you're going to be a part of it. Stay tuned, folks. More great stuff is on the way, and shalom.
Do you like picking strawberries or blueberries in the spring and summer? What about grapes? If you were to take an experience like picking grapes and move it to the heartland of Israel, this is when an experience becomes prophetic. Young and old, singles and families are all invited on this adventure of a lifetime. I'm Joshua Waller with Hayuvel, and I invite you to join us on the mountains of Israel where prophecy meets reality. Go to Hayuvel.com, that's H-A-Y-O-V-E-L.com for more information.